This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Our guest helps us brighten up our winter meals with lemons, limes, oranges, and more citrus. Now, members of the U.S. Navy have been fishing pieces of a Chinese balloon out of the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Myrtle Beach. That's after an American F-22 fighter jet shot it out of the sky. American officials are saying they believe the balloon was designed to conduct surveillance, though China has said it was for gathering weather information. The incident came at a rocky moment in diplomatic relations between the U.S. and China, with fears about Taiwan and long-running disputes over trade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction? What questions do you have about this balloon story and the current relationship between the U.S. and China? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rosalind Shea is Associate Professor of Political Science and Coordinator for the Certificate in Political Economy at Temple University, where she's affiliated with the Asian Studies and Global Studies programs. Her latest book is called Micro-Institutional Foundations of Capitalism, Sectoral Pathways to Globalization in China, India, and Russia. Rosalind, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I know we don't know all the details about the balloon yet. We'll see what is found, what information the U.S. government releases. What do you see as the significance here? How big a deal is this?
Yeah, so what new information we do know about the balloon is we know more context, both the fact that it is part of a larger surveillance program run by the People's Liberation Army, and it involves balloons that have dozens of balloons and dozens of missions since 2018 to across more than 40 countries, five continents. So we know information about the larger context. We know more information, bits and pieces as we gather more information about the content of the balloon. And so in that sense, what we know is that it's not new. The duration inside U.S. territory flying over continental U.S. Is new. It, was much longer duration, and it came inside continental U.S. So those are some of the what we're learning about the balloon. What does it mean? I think it's both increasingly because of what we're learning about the fact that it is a larger program. In a sense, it is a national security potential issue, but it increasingly can also become a global security issue. And so that is something that, of course, drawing both partisan, bipartisan concern. And that's why we saw yesterday the passage of the resolution in the House that was unanimous in terms of condemning China for the activities and also appealing to the Biden administration to continue to give us more information as the U.S. learns more information.
And Rosalind, people might think balloon and think, century or 150-year-old technology, really antiquated. You, I understand, are interested in actually the high-tech nature of these surveillance balloons and what we can learn from them. What has you interested in that?
Yeah, what's really interesting about these balloons is this marriage of, antiquated or older technology, but also this marriage with more high-tech materials and something that the Chinese government has identified as important, in Made in China 2025 in terms of technological advancement. And so we have, on one hand, kind of pretty conventional textiles, but on the other hand, we have communications materials added into these textiles. So technical materials, technical textiles, smart textiles. And what we're learning also is that the addition of the communications into antiquated or what just traditional technology actually allows the Chinese government to gather signals intelligence. Enabling signals intelligence capabilities. So on one hand, you have these balloons potentially not necessarily gathering any more information than satellite technology. But on the other hand, the balloons allows for surveillance that's could be longer in duration in particular spots, and can go into potentially areas where there may be defense capabilities of the countries in which the balloons are passing through. And so have security implications, but also reveals to us the technological capabilities that China has. And also another thing quite important is it reveals the civil-military fusion and dual-use technologies that Chinese private companies now have capabilities of. And so on one hand, you have companies that are engaging purely in commercial activities. But on the other hand, they're also working closely with the PLA, Chinese defense. And so the increasing number of these companies reveals to us that, you know, a traditional measure of state control, such as state ownership, is increasingly not the only measure of looking at authoritarian state control in China. But as I find in my work on different dimensions of market governance, that it's about state ownership, but it's also about the role of the state at the firm level, at the sector level. And we're seeing civil-military relations and the production of dual-use technologies. And what I believe is that what we need to be aware of as we see more of these companies operating is that the United States, in addition to, you know, export controls, entity lists, and so forth, we should have more market-oriented policies such as continued diversification of our supply chains, because it is very difficult increasingly to identify whether, how much a commercial company may also be involved in defense security-related activities for the Chinese government.
Talking to Rosalind Shea from Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relationships after this balloon incident. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. I'm shocked. I'm just shocked that China would actually be spying on us. But that being said, I think this is blown way out of proportion. It's much to do about nothing. Everybody's been spying on everybody as far back as we have history. And I don't know what the big deal is. I mean, we spy on them. They spy on us. They got caught, whatever. And I think part of it now is the fact that it's a political football, and it's something that if the Republicans keep it stirred up, it makes Biden look bad, maybe, and it turned into a political thing. But realistically, I don't know what everybody's upset about.
You know? Mike, thanks for the call, Rosa. No big deal. Mike says Republicans and some Democrats in Congress raising questions for the White House. How do you see the domestic politics side of this playing out, maybe here and in China?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we did see the bipartisan resolution that was passed yesterday. So in that sense, this is a cross-party issue. So it's not just about politics, you know, for the Republicans and vis-a-vis the Democrats per se. Now, what is true was that the original content of the resolution was going to be much more condemning of the Biden administration's response or handling of the situation. And so the final resolution that was passed was something that was less condemning of the administration's handling. And so what we're seeing is that this is actually potentially an opportunity for both parties to work together. Now, addressing what the caller said about, you know, what is new about this, right? Countries all over the world spy on each other. As I mentioned earlier about the context, this is kind of a larger, program. And what is new? Is this something we should be necessarily concerned about? Again, I want to kind of bring to the context, right? That there is a global context here. We have Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the war going on right now. And China not, you know, coming out explicitly condemning Russia for the invasion of Ukraine. So there is a global context that we are looking at and considering as well. And the longer term program, you know, we're learning more about the balloons and what the balloons are capable of. And so that longer term program is something that I do think that both parties should be watching very carefully and thinking about.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking about U.S.-China relations amid the developing story about the Chinese balloon that an American jet shot down over the Atlantic. Rosalind Shea is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions to this story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Rosalind Shea, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, looking at the latest in U.S.-China relations after the downing of this Chinese balloon. I've got a clip of President Biden talking to Judy Woodruff from PBS NewsHour during his visit earlier this week to DeForest, Wisconsin. Here's a listen.
Look, I mean, the idea of shooting down a balloon that's gathering information over America makes relations worse. Look, I made it real clear to Xi Jinping that we're going to compete fully with China, but we're not looking for conflict, and that's been the case so far.
So compete with China, but it sounds like not trying to escalate conflicts. Rosalind, what do you make of what you've seen from the White House over the course of this?
Yeah, I think that the handling so far has been very sober and not reactive, in the sense that the Biden administration gave China a chance, an opportunity to respond. And then from there, then had canceled the Secretary of State's trip that was planned to Beijing. Secretary Blinken was supposed to meet with Xi Jinping on Sunday. It was, you know, as we know, subsequently handled. But there was an opportunity that the Biden administration gave China to respond, and they responded by saying this was a weather balloon, that it was not anything more than that. And of course, we have intelligence, and we know that that is not true. And then from there, the trip was canceled. And so, indeed, I believe what Biden said is true. We want to compete with China, and we do not want conflict. And the way the administration responded was quite sober and not reactive.
Let's go back to our callers. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. I'm just listening to the conversation here, and I just have to say that, you know, this being the flashpoint that it is, the balloon, what have you, I think this is just a nod to understanding what China's economic leverage is here, and that we need to take a more sobering look at China's economic policies across the Western Hemisphere, not just within the United States, in an ever heightening tension between the Western Hemisphere and the East. Are we potentially funding this war against ourselves? If, you know, we are pouring so much money into the Chinese economy.
Gotcha, and Chris. Point taken. Rosalind, are we funding a potential near-term adversary with our economic ties with China?
You know, indeed, what the caller said about, you know, potential fears of doing so, and which, you know, leads me to go back to what I said earlier about diversifying our supply chains, right? We don't want to be in a situation where we inadvertently invest into one of these civil military, fusion companies producing dual use technology. And so by working with our allies, our economic partners across the world, and investing in them to create ecosystems where countries in the global south, and also in the newly industrialized countries of Asia, Eastern Europe, and Latin America, we then could create new supply chains around the world. And that would be proactive rather than reactive, and also market-oriented rather than just simply protectionist.
Chris, thanks for that call. Mark joins us now in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. A previous caller had indicated he didn't understand what the big deal was. The big deal is this is not a satellite flying over. This is a brazen and direct violation of our airspace. And if you don't take a direct action, they'll just become more emboldened. And I know there's been some people talking about how by shooting down the balloon, it can make our relations with the Chinese worse. Shooting down the balloon doesn't make them worse. What makes them worse is the Chinese sending the balloon here to begin with.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Rosalind, I think an important distinction between a satellite and something in U.S. airspace. If we were to float balloons blatantly over China, I think they might react poorly. Is there something significant about a, you know, physical aircraft of this sort in our airspace?
Yeah, as it has been pointed out that, you know, in many ways, the technologies on the balloons are not all that different from satellite technology that the Chinese already employ. But a major difference is indeed the fact that this is, you know, flying over U.S. airspace and possible for the naked eye in certain instances to see it. And that really, to the American domestic audience, will elicit a reaction. And indeed, that's what has occurred. And part of the bipartisan responses has a lot to do with the fact that constituencies across Republican and Democratic areas are you know, noticing and definitely reacting to the fact that these balloons have been cited, and they will continue to react to the fact that, as we're learning, this is a much larger program that the Chinese has brought out
over the years. Thanks for that call, Mark. We just have a few moments left, Rosalind. Briefly, what are you watching for next?
Yeah, I'm you know, interested to see what the Biden administration will do in terms of working with our multilateral and using multilateral tools and working with our allies and partners around the world. Because the fact that this is a larger program and has, you know, affected not just the United States, but countries around the world from, you know, Asia to Latin America, we'd be interested to see how we're going to work with our allies, because this can be potentially a global security issue, not just a national security issue. Now, you know, indeed, we are working with the Philippines. And in fact, our defense secretary was in the Philippines when the news broke about the balloon over Montana. And one of the reasons why we were in the Philippines was to set up these nuclear operations, military bases, one of which faces or is across away from Taiwan.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Rosalind Shea, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. We talked to her today about the latest in a story about the Chinese balloon that the U.S. shot down over the Atlantic and where things are in the U.S. relationship with China. District attorney's offices around Wisconsin are struggling to hire enough lawyers. Got so bad in one Wisconsin county that the local DA said he had no choice but to resign. As Sarah Lear reports, the shortage is part of a trend happening around the country.
For more than a decade, Kurt Klomberg served as Dodge County's top prosecutor. He says the county typically files charges in more than 1,000 criminal cases each year. This year, Klomberg was facing a crisis. The office's four assistant district attorneys were soon to be gone, in part because of retirements. Faced with few applicants to fill those positions, Klomberg, too, handed in his notice. He says there was no way for him to responsibly handle the caseload on his own.
I realized that that was going to cause me to probably commit multiple acts of malpractice just because I wouldn't have the time to properly address my cases.
The staffing crunch is a problem statewide. Close to 12% of Wisconsin's assistant DA jobs are vacant, and turnover is high. Klomberg and other prosecutors say low pay is largely to blame. Starting pay for Wisconsin's assistant DAs is less than $57,000 a year, while recent law school grads in private practice can make, on average, nearly $140,000 a year. Attorney Jennifer Tate says it's a big problem. The 36-year-old used to work at a private defense firm, but took a pay cut to work as an assistant DA in Milwaukee County. When it became clear she couldn't make ends meet, she took a second job hostessing at a restaurant.
I just kind of laid it all out there, and I said, I work full-time as a lawyer. I have three kids. I'm getting divorced. I'm going to have them half of the time. Here is when I'm available.
Now, the Wisconsin District Attorneys Association is urging state lawmakers to raise starting pay for both assistant district attorneys and assistant public defenders to more than $72,000 a year. It's part of the battle across the country to recruit and retain lawyers, some of whom have six figures of law school debt.
Wisconsin is not an outlier at all.
Melba Pearson of Florida International University is a civil rights attorney and former prosecutor. She says it doesn't help that local prosecutors have heavy caseloads and often can't work remotely.
This is happening nationwide. Prosecutors' offices in all 50 states, whether it be conservative jurisdictions, progressive jurisdictions, anything in between, are really struggling.
In Wisconsin, the state's Bar Association says a lack of experienced prosecutors, coupled with the shortage of public defenders, is so bad it's approaching a constitutional crisis. Many courts are still wading through a post-pandemic backlog, and some attorneys just aren't available. That's often caused frustration for victims, and in some cases, forced people accused of crimes to wait longer in jail. And Pearson notes overworked prosecutors have less time to weigh life-altering decisions, like when to charge someone with a crime and what to recommend for bail.
You may end up in a situation where you're more likely to plea a case out just because of the fact that you have too many cases and it's just not possible to work up each case the way it needs to be.
In Dodge County, they're working to resolve the problem. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has appointed a new district attorney, and retired prosecutors have been helping out part-time. But staffing is still uncertain. Like so many DA's offices, Dodge County is pleading for applicants. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the program with the latest news on a task force aimed at preventing human trafficking here in Wisconsin. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. The U.S. loves bears, but beavers are a bigger part of Wisconsin, at least when it comes to place names. The data department at the Washington Post ran the numbers to find the most popular animals and place names around the country and in each state. As far as I can tell, the data includes, you know, your cities, towns, counties, plus parks and waterways and more. The number one animal and place names around the U.S. is the bear, and bear is number one in 23 states. But here in Wisconsin, beaver is the most popular animal, showing up in 155 places, including Beaver Dam, three towns named Beaver, and Beaver Brook and Beaver Edge, plus creeks and preserves and trails. The list goes on. Beaver is the number one animal also in eight other states. Bonus fact, the number one alcohol in place names in Wisconsin is, I guess no surprise, brandy. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup. The GOP reckons with a rowdy State of the Union, the Federal Reserve sends a signal on future interest rates, and LeBron James sets a new NBA record. That and more today on 1A+. Now it's Food Friday. If you're looking for a way to brighten up your winter cooking and add some flavor and warmth to a dish, you might be in need of some citrus fruits. Our Food Friday guest talks with us about ways that she uses citrus in her cooking and how it can change a dish. If you're looking for locally sourced citrus, well, you're out of luck there. But good news, citrus is available, not too expensive, at least what I'm seeing on the shelves at the grocery store. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to use, you know, limes, lemons, oranges? The list goes on in your cooking. What do you like to put it in? Or do you have questions about how to use these things in your sweet and savory cooking? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Gunst is a cookbook author, writer, and resident chef for NPR's Here and Now. In 2015, she was a James Beard Award-winning journalist. Her latest cookbook is Rage Baking, The Transformative Power of Flour, Fury, and Women's Voices. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, this idea for citrus came from you. I understand you're just really happy to use citrus these days. What's going on?
Well, several things. I am spending a little bit of time this winter in LA because my daughter lives here, and I am lucky enough to be surrounded by an incredible array of citrus, some of which I've never even heard of, and I am pretty much obsessed with it at this point.
What is it about citrus? I have found, I'll say this. One of my biggest discoveries in cooking is using citrus at the end of like a soup or stew. If yes. I think it's about some of the boringest foods I've made and some of the best, I put a lentil soup in each category. One of them had lemon. One of them didn't. What is it about citrus in savory cooking that just makes things pop so well?
That's such a great example because, excuse me. My throat. Sorry.
That's okay. It happens.
It's like I just bit into a lemon. citrus has the ability to awaken other flavors, and adding it to savory foods at the end, in that example you just gave, a lentil soup, a seafood stew, virtually anything, it brightens all the flavors that are already in there, and it brings a brightness that you might not have. So a soup like lentil, which can be dark and heavy, and maybe the, you know, it feels comforting and it's filling, but it can feel dull. A little bit of grated lemon zest or lemon juice just brightens the whole thing up. And it has that ability in sweet and savory.
Now, it's great. We're not in LA. We don't have citrus trees growing in our backyard right now or anytime. But but we could pick up oranges and lemons and limes and grapefruit pretty much all year round in stores. Something I'm seeing pop up more lately the last few years, blood oranges and Cara oranges, not like in a specialty grocery. Are those things you've used? Are those things you I love them. Do you think people should seek them out to use in cooking?
Definitely. No, I mean, I live in Maine, so I live in a climate much closer to yours. And I understand that, you know, when you don't live in Southern California, you're dependent on your grocery store. Cara have become increasingly popular. They look like a regular old navel orange, but when you cut them open, they have this beautiful pinkish, almost red orange flesh. And they're sometimes called the red navel, and they're sweet and tangy. And best of all, they have low acidity and no seeds. So it's almost like a cross between a grapefruit and an orange. And then you mentioned
blood oranges.
Blood oranges, love them. They are dramatically colored. They look like blood red, little bit of orange flesh. They have a ton of vitamin C and fiber. They're great for juicing. I've been just drinking that like for breakfast, but they're also great in salads, and you can bake with it. Now, you have to be aware that when you use blood orange juice rather than plain old orange juice, it's going to affect the color. And so you want to be really conscious of not, you know, making a stew or something look even darker by adding the blood orange. But I've been experimenting a lot with salads where I'll take watercress or arugula or any whatever the freshest looking lettuce leaf that you can get your hands on at this time of year. And then I will just very thinly slice as many different varieties of citrus as I can get. So maybe a tangerine, a navel orange, a Cara, a blood orange, maybe even a Meyer lemon. And then I will sprinkle the whole citrus salad with crumbled feta cheese and crushed up pistachios. And that's almost like taking a trip to LA.
Talking to Kathy Gunst on this week's edition of Food Friday, resident chef for NPR's Here and Now. We are cooking with citrus. You can find some recipes that Kathy shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday, including something a lot like she was just talking about, the California citrus salad with dates, feta, and pistachios with a citrus vinaigrette. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does citrus fruit enter into your cooking and or baking? How do you use it? What do you like it in? Or what questions do you have about cooking with the wonderful world of citrus? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kathy, I mentioned that that California citrus salad. You're giving us some of the parts of it there. Now, that one you've got with the radicchio or other bitter greens like arugula you mentioned just a few moments ago. How do the citrus flavors play with those kind of bitter greens, which are honestly sometimes too bitter for Rob?
That's a great question, because the reason I paired them together is that radicchio or arugula can be really bitter for some people. So imagine layering it with these sweet, juicy citrus slices. Somehow the combination of the really the pow of flavor of an orange and a tangerine and a caracara on top of the bitter greens, they all balance each other out beautifully. And then the pistachios add great crunch, a little bit of salt, the feta cheese adds creaminess, and then you can add dates if you can find them. They're dried, they're often next to dried figs in grocery stores. And then a citrus vinaigrette is something worth talking about for a minute, because most vinaigrette are just mustard, salt, pepper, and then olive oil and some sort of vinegar or lemon juice. So what I do is when I cut the oranges and the grapefruit and whatever I'm using for this salad, I'll keep the peel. I'll do mustard, salt, pepper, and then I add any juice that's left from the orange peels. Often little bits of the flesh will be clinging to them. I'll squeeze that into the vinaigrette. Then I add just straight lemon juice or Meyer lemons. I am super fan of Meyer lemons, which are very smooth skin lemon, like a cross between an orange and a lemon. They're so delicious, you could almost just bite into one, if you can believe it. And then I add olive oil. So the citrus comes up with the lemon and also any orange from the oranges that you've cut. And this is a vinaigrette that would go well with any salad for the winter.
Now, how about the zest from our oranges and lemons and limes? Where do you like to use that? Where you just grate a little bit of the peel off there?
Yeah, so let's just be clear that whenever you're using citrus, even if it says organic, if you want to zest it, you should always wash it really well and then thoroughly dry it. It's really hard to get the zest off if it's wet. And then I use a microplane or the little knobby bits of a box cheese grater. And you want to grate the zest, which is the orange part on the orange or the lemon part of the yellow part on the lemon or the green part on the lime. But you don't want to go too deep, because then you get into the pith, P-I-T-H, which is quite bitter. And it's that white part that's just beneath the colored zest. So when you're zesting, don't sort of get into a chat with someone and forget what you're doing. Because you'll get, I've done that, and I'm like, why is this so bitter? And then I'll look at the poor, pathetic lemon, and I'm like, oh, I massacred it. I like to use zest. I will sprinkle it into soups. I will sprinkle it onto salads. I'll sprinkle it into drinks or cocktails. It's got the oils from the citrus, so it's really flavorful and lively. And it's normally a part of the fruit that you throw away. So citrus is fairly reasonably priced, but this is a way where you won't waste any of it.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Kathy Gunst, cookbook author, writer, resident chef for NPR's Here and Now. She's joining us for Food Friday to talk about cooking with citrus. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to brighten up your winter cooking with one form of citrus or another? Or is there a favorite summertime salad you like to make with it? Do you use the zest in something? Do you have questions for our guests about what to do with our citrus fruits in our cooking? Call in now at 800-642-1234 to join the Food Friday conversation. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kathy Gunst, a cookbook author, writer, and resident chef for NPR's Here and Now. She's with us on Food Friday with lots of great advice on using citrus fruits in our cooking. I love to do this. It's winter time. I think that citrus flavor is you kind of cheat a little bit and get a little taste of summer. How about you? Nobody else likes to do this out there, I guess. If you do, you could call it at 800-642-1234. Let us know where citrus shows up in your cooking and or baking. Do you have a favorite or do you have a question? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kathy, you mentioned zest as a way to get even more value out of our citrus. And one of your recipes you shared with us, we get even more candied citrus peels. How do we do it?
That's really cool. Talk about no waste. They're very expensive when you buy them in sort of specialty food shops. It's not that hard. What you do is you take a wide mouth peeler and you peel, again, you've washed the citrus, you've dried it, and then you peel it off or use a small sharp knife to cut the peel. You cut it into long, thick, sort of quarter inch strips, and you put it in a saucepan with cold water, bring it to a boil. And you do this twice. And what you're doing is softening the peel. So are you with me? You just cut the peel off, boiling water, drain it, put it in more water, boiling water, drain it again. Then you take the drained peels and you add half a cup of sugar and about a quarter cup of fresh citrus juice. Now you could use orange if you're using oranges, but you could also use tangerine or grapefruit. You could mix it up. And then you let it simmer for 20 minutes. So it's basically in a sugar syrup. Also a half a cup of cold water, sorry. So half a cup of sugar, half a cup of water, quarter cup of fresh citrus juice. Let it simmer away in there for about 20 minutes. It's gonna get thick and gooey and soft. And then you're going to take the peels out. You're going to strain the syrup and keep it because it is fabulous in cocktails, mocktails, mixed with seltzer water, added to vinaigrettes. And then you're going to let these peels that have been sugared, they're going to dry. And then you place a sheet of parchment paper on your work surface. You put all the peels out there to dry. And then you're going to toss them with some extra sugar and let them dry. And they will keep for months. And they are so good as a snack, served with tea, to decorate cakes and cookies. Very beautiful. And you can do it with any type of citrus.
We've got that recipe from Kathy at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Doug is with us in Three Lakes. Doug, hi.
Good afternoon. Enjoying the conversation. My question is, can zest and juice be stored for later use?
Oh, interesting. So if I want to zest the whole thing and keep some for later, Kathy.
Yeah, it's a good question. I would juice it and I would then put the zest into the juice and freeze it and put it in a well-sealed container. And I would say to freeze it for no more than 3 months. But by adding it to the juice, the zest won't dry out or get ice crystals. It'll be protected by the moisture of the citrus juice. But great question, and absolutely. You can also just keep it in the fridge for about a week or so. The only problem with that is if you want to use the zest separately from the juice, you can wrap it tightly in parchment paper, or I don't like to use plastic, but some type of good wrap, and keep it in the fridge for several days. But the oils in the citrus are sort of lively while the fruit is whole. And the minute you zest them, it starts to dry out. So you want to use it fairly quickly.
Doug, thanks a lot for calling in. Hope that helps. I want to check out one more recipe you shared with us again at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, this is our meal recipe for the afternoon. A roast salmon with tangerines and fennel with an orange butter sauce. Can you talk about the tangerines and orange here and the role in this salmon?
Yeah, this is, you take a fillet of salmon. You could do this really with any type of fish. And you are going to roast it. A fennel bulb is something that I love. You thinly slice it, throw it around the salmon, a little olive oil and chives. You put it into the oven, and then you're going to surround it with tangerine slices. And the orange butter sauce is simply a matter of melting some butter, again, some orange zest, orange juice, and really satisfying winter eating.
That sounds fantastic. Again, we have that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Do you do a lot with citrus in baking? I know I've made, you know, lemon bars and things like that. What are some of our good uses of citrus there?
Well, I do have a recipe for lemon bars that comes from a wonderful baker named Valerie Lomas. This is from my new book called Rage Baking. And what I love about these lemon bars is that it's almost like you make a homemade lemon curd, but you don't have to spend all this time at the stove whipping and beating all these ingredients to make it. You make a really simple crust with flour, confectioner's sugar, and some butter and salt. And then the lemon filling, which is just eggs, sugar, lots of fresh lemon juice, some flour and baking powder. You whisk all that together, you throw it into the crust, and it tastes like homemade lemon curd. These lemon bars are such a hit.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Molly is with us in Milwaukee. Molly, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about?
Well, I wanted to ask about citrus fruit as a trigger for GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder. Several members of my family have that, and we have been told to avoid citrus. And I love citrus, and I'd love the guests' ideas on how to include citrus in a GERD diet.
Well, Molly, I'll say I have the reflux. Happily, citrus doesn't seem to trigger me. But you mentioned earlier, Kathy, one of the kinds of citrus was a lower acid, and I can't remember which one it was.
I did. I also suffer from it. So I'm actually not sitting here going, oh my God, I can't answer this woman's question. The blood oranges are very low in acid. You want to look for low acid fruit. Caraqueras are slightly less acidic than a regular old navel orange. I have trouble with grapefruit. I would say to use it sparingly and make it a special occasion when you do it, but I completely understand it's a tough thing to deal with and a tough diet. And sometimes people just can't tolerate citrus, but often in grocery stores, they will label low acid citrus. And those are the ones you want to look for.
Awesome. Thanks, Molly, for calling in, talking to Kathy Gunst on this edition of Food Friday, cooking with citrus. We'll bring on James now in Waukesha. James, hi. Are you there, James? I'm not hearing James. I guess we lost him along the way somewhere there. He says he always has a picture of ice cold water and just has lemons and limes. And I love a good lemon or lime water. Kathy, any other thoughts for, you know, sometimes I want a cocktail. I don't want alcohol, though, and I'll make little concoctions with whatever citrus is lying around. Do you have anything you like to do along those lines?
Definitely. I mean, I don't drink that much, so I'm constantly experimenting. Meyer lemons are terrific, mixed with some seltzer, a little bit of blood orange in it. You can also make citrus ice cubes where you mix a little bit of water with a lot of fresh citrus juice and then pop those into drinks. You could use it with apple cider and make a warm drink. Of course, citrus is just full of vitamin C, so it's very helpful this time of year.
All right. Thanks for passing along that question. Scott is with us in Hayward now. Scott, hi.
Hi. I was going to mention chimichurri. We use that for dipping our backstrap, venison backstrap in. You cook it, you know, semi-medium rare or whatever, and you just take a couple bunches of cilantro, a bunch of parsley, 4 or 5 cloves of garlic, some onion or something like that, then the juice of like 6 limes and olive oil, and you just blend it all and add a little salt. I also like to put a whole jalapeno in there, or 2 if you'd like it really spicy. And then you
Sounds
just use
fabulous.
That, you know, you cool it. Let it sit, and you can use it for dipping venison in, which is really good.
Scott, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Kathy, that reminds me, lime and cilantro together for me is just a magical combination.
Oh, totally. One of my favorites. Lots of salsas made with lime juice, lime zest, lime. But chimichurri is such a great sauce and so adaptable. Sometimes I'll just do a winter parsley sauce where I'll throw a bunch of fresh parsley, which is always inexpensive and always available, with a lot of fresh lime juice, lime zest, a little olive oil. And you've got this perfect sauce for fish, chicken, meat, roasted vegetables. Again, that lime is going to wake all the other foods up in a really bright, just delicious way that defies February.
Scott, thanks for the call. And Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks. And I hope you can smuggle some citrus up here to Wisconsin.
I wish I could. And I just wanted to say, if anybody wants to know anything about classes I'm teaching or other recipes, my website is just Kathy Gunst, KathyGunst.com.
That's Kathy Gunst. We'll get a link to her website at WPR.org/Central Time. Kathy's a cookbook author, writer, and resident chef for NPR's Here and Now. Her most recent cookbook is called Rage Baking, The Transformative Power of Flour, Fury, and Women's Voices. She joined us today for Food Friday to talk about citrus and how citrus fruits can brighten up our winter cooking. Still time for you to share your favorites over at the Ideas Network Facebook page and find three of those recipes from Kathy at WPR.org/Food Friday, that California citrus salad, candied citrus peels, and a roast salmon with tangerines and fennel with an orange butter sauce. All sounds really good. Find it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, some states are looking to restrict or ban live drag shows. We'll look at the history of drag performances, what happens at shows, and pushback over the years' backlash, especially from some conservative politicians. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk with a New Yorker staff writer, Rachel Aviv, about her new book, Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.